not quite a work in progress. It is in the book. That is, it's part of a chapter of the book, but it's also not finished material. That is, as you'll see from my presentation, this is something I didn't quite get a complete handle on. That is, when I was preparing this, and I'll tell you why in the course of the talk, why it's important to talk about repetition when you're talking about Nitzhui Levitsky, I was looking for solutions, and in the end, the solution I found is only a partial solution. That is, it doesn't answer all the questions I had, but at some point, I was frustrated. And so this is the kind of work where I'm not even sure I'm coming back to this. I may come back to this. I mean, if as a result of this talk, you give me some really great ideas that I could pursue, maybe I will pursue this. But in fact, I've embarked on another project already that isn't this. But it's the kind of thing that interests me. And so it is a work that I would return to, but it's also something I've already published. Let me begin like a good graduate student or an applicant for a grant by fending off in advance all the comments that people will naturally make about the varieties of repetition that I'm not really using. I won't say I'm not really using them, but we have any number of ways of understanding how repetition works in literature. The first one is philosophically. And Deleuze is probably the best example. I mean, his book on difference and repetition. But Deleuze, typical of a whole host of people who look at repetition, understands repetition exclusively in a philosophical sense. That is, for him, the problem with repetition is that everything has to be put into the context of time, and time, because it flows, essentially means that there is no such thing as repetition. That is, this is the old adage that you can't step in the same river twice. And so for Deleuze, repetition of the kind we are interested in doesn't exist. And for Deleuze, repetition is in fact a unique event that cannot be duplicated. So that's the philosophical approach. Another approach to repetition in literature is intertextuality, right? You know, Christopher Genet are, you know, the hallmarks of this. But the problem with looking at intertextuality as a form of repetition, it's an obvious form of repetition, but it's one that's so limited to a subset. That is, intertextuality as an approach to repetition doesn't give you a wide scope to work with. That is, you are limited to textual repetitions from another text. It won't answer the kinds of questions that are raised by the material I was looking at. There's the linguistic approach to repetition, which for me essentially boils down to Roman Jakobson, right? Jakobson, in that famous quotation of his, is essentially talking about the function of aesthetics in the written word as a factor related to repetition. That is, if you explore what he means by equivalence, it's not the same thing as repetition, but it's close. That is, it includes repetition as one of the equivalences. And so this gives us some potential to talk about the work of art as including repetition at a very fundamental level. But once again, this is definitional, and it's not really a tool that, you know, it's not a can opener you're going to use to open this can. It's just a theory that describes how things might work. And so he too isn't all that useful for the kind of work I needed to do. Architecturally, there's a lot more to talk about. Let me go back. Architecturally, repetition is a quality of the construction of the work itself. There are so many different architectural elements that involve repetition, most of them very simple and familiar. You know, characters who are doubles of other characters, characters with features that repeat, characters who perform the same actions as other characters, places, return to places. That's one of the simplest forms of repetition, is just a return to the same place in a work, right? When it's marked. Obviously, things like objects, situations, actions. All of these, however, turn out to be simply markers of repetition. That is, if we think architecturally, if we think about the construction of a work, what role does repetition play in the construction of a work? There are some very simple ideas, and I will be using those. There should be more complex ideas, but they're not very well developed. Repetition in rhetoric, of course, this may be the simplest of all of our approaches. And we've got, you know, I pulled up a list from somewhere. I think this may be Wikipedia. Right. Yeah. Of all of the various devices of repetition. But what do you do with all of those? So you know it's an anapalepsis. Right? What does it tell you? And if you go into all the rhetorical textbooks, it's always emphasis. That is, what is the function, what's the purpose of rhetorical advice? Well, it's to call attention. That pretty much we can count on, although I'll throw a caveat into that. But rhetoric also doesn't give us very useful tools for how to go about applying repetition to an analysis of a work of literature. Music, certainly one of the most obvious comparisons for how we're going to use repetition, and almost all of these are relevant to literature, that is, but they work differently, keeping time being the best example. That is, we don't keep time in a work of literature the way we keep time in a work of music. I realize modern works of music don't even keep time this way, but sticking just to traditional musical schemes, traditional musical scales, also repetition. Language works a little differently. It doesn't quite have the same kind of markers. Rhythm in language is something that repetition can do, and we'll be talking about that. Creating harmony and providing structure the way a symphony provides structure with repetition, you know, these are complex ideas that I'd like to find ways, and people write about this. It's not, you know, when you go out and look at how repetition is handled in the literature, people are trying to do this. But I will tell you right off the bat, not with very great success. The last category I just had there and went past accidentally is accidental repetition. Accidental repetition is, in fact, not just a joke. Accidental repetition raises a whole host of very important issues. If that is, if we look for what an accidental definition, a definition of an accidental repetition would be, it would be not deliberate. We assume that repetition in a work of art is deliberate, but it doesn't have to be. I mean, let me give you an example from Nichui, just so I get a little bit of Nichui in here. In a work titled No Dnakvi Mistashkame, he has a character, a very minor character, who's an ogre. He's the prison director, director of prisons in Kyiv. And Nichui brands him early in the work as a carrier of the St. George Medal. And it's mostly a throwaway line. That is, it just that is, he's a careerist, so he cares to have a St. George Medal. And late in the work, Nichui repeats it. There's a sentence that says, and he had, you know, he was a carrier of the St. George Medal. And even I, who have gotten quite used to all the repetition in Nichui, I hit this sentence and it seems to me, you know, did Nichui forget that he told us this already? Because it's not a significant phrase. It's just a tiny bit of characterization meant to, you know, signal that he's a careerist. I don't know. Did Nichui make a mistake? Right. That raises the whole issue, another set of problems tied to repetition. The first is that Cowan, a theorist of repetition from back in the 60s, calls it destructive repetition. Simply put, this is the difference between good and bad repetition. That is, when is repetition something undesirable? When is repetition repetitive? And when is it a constructive force in a work of art? Naturally, the more you think about this, the more you realize that this is largely dependent on the next issue, which is the perceiver of the repetition. That is, the same repetition, the same facts of repetition, will be perceived by one reader differently than they will be by another reader. There is, in fact, the whole question of an awareness of repetition. Go back to the musical example for repetition. To what degree is a listener aware of all the patterns of repetition that exist in a musical work? Do they function nonetheless, whether the perceiver is aware of them or not? When you apply this to literature, we are in even deeper water. That is, can we deal with the issue of repetition of which the reader is unaware? And because I'm still old-fashioned and I like authors, what happens when the author is unaware of repetition? That is, it's not intentional, it's not deliberate in some crafted way. All of this is extremely problematical, and all of the you know, all of our theorizing about repetition needs to come to terms with this. It's in that context that, you know, I turn to my friend here, Ivan Nichui Levitsky. It should be apparent by now that for Nichui, as I like to call him, repetition is a very important device. There's lots and lots and lots of it. So what I'm going to do is not look at repetition in Nichui's work, but look at those critics who wrote about Nichui's work and how they reacted to what they perceived as repetition and approach the question from that perspective. Nichui is a very old-fashioned 19th century writer. I was going to say realist writer, but even the realist part can be put in doubt. That is, to what extent he is a realist. I call him a realist. I think he belongs in that category, but it's certainly something that can be disputed. His reputation in scholarship is largely dependent on one man. Serhiy Efremov wrote a biography of Mikhail Levitsky in the 1920s, and his biography set the stage for almost all Mikhail studies following. There's one thing, however, that needs to be said about Efremov and Nitschui, is their relationship. I go into great depth in the book, and this is an important part of what I'm doing in the book. Their relationship was somewhat hostile. Nitschui was 30 and 40 years older than Efremov. He's a man from a different generation. And at the end of the 19th century, this was very important. That is, the young whippersnappers had a very different idea of what was happening to Ukrainian culture than did the old guard. Nitschui's name was very well known as a writer. Efremov got involved in publishing, and naturally he wanted to publish Nitschui's works because Nitschui is one of the better known writers. And he does, and he's publishing Nitschui's work. But he's publishing Nitschui's work, and he is standardizing the orthography. Now, Ukrainian orthography at the beginning of the 20th century is in flux. There are all kinds of problems between the Western Ukraine and Eastern Ukraine. And so Nitschui has his own peculiar views on this issue. And there are great anecdotes where, you know, Nitschui and Efremov are passing manuscripts back and forth. Efremov is correcting them to whatever he thinks is supposed to be the orthography, sending them to the author for proofreading. The author is getting mad. He's fixing all this back to what he wants. Eventually, there was a blow-up, and they stopped cooperating. Right? So in that context, one of the things that we need to be sensitive to is Efremov's understanding of Nitschui as someone who is old-fashioned, who's out of it. That is, he will consistently do that. And his biography, which set the tone for almost all Nitschui studies, is, you know, it panders to a great writer as an old dinosaur. That is, it's very condescending, and it talks about Nitschui, you know, as one of our important writers. But, you know, he's a has-been. He's from a different age. So in that context, let me read you. I'll read it in English. You can just look at it in Ukrainian.
Wait a minute now. What happened to Ukrainian?
It's now in English, yes. I just let you look at it. Well, if you want me to go back, I'll go back and... Okay, and I'll read you the English version.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Like folk poetry, Levitsky knows no other artistic device than comparison. Quoting, "His brown eyes shone like candles. Khomenko was handsome, fresh, and young. Of course he was handsome, so handsome you want to disarrange him a little. Ruffle his clothes, dishevel his hair, reduce his beauty." This is a critic writing about a text that he's praising, right? Right? Yeah. "Mannerism, manipulation, artificiality, monotony, and wordiness are in evidence here. Levitsky paints all of his heroes, especially heroines, with identical conventional colors, and that's why they often acquire monotonous, conventional, one might say, academic superficiality." Yeah, this is a biography in praise of Nitschui, and this is what he's saying. And because he was so influential, that is, we get more of this. But notice in what he's saying how much of this comes down to repetition. It's monotonous, right? It's repetitive, right? With that in mind, let's move to one of my favorite Ukrainian writers, But in this case, we're going to look at him not as a writer, but as a critic. Valerian Pidmoheny in the 19...
That's the same. Those are two different pictures of him at different ages, right?
Oh, no.
Nichoy on the right and Pidmoheny. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, Pidmoheny is the dapper young one.
Got it. Okay, yeah. Yeah.
And dapper young one, that is, he was, I think, 22 years old when he wrote the text I'm going to read to you. And he was really full of himself. This is a man, he is writing an introduction to a volume of collected Nichoy works. And this is not the way you write introductions. That is, he starts, the whole point of his introduction is to say that Nichoy as a writer has many faults. Right. one of the topics that was very current in the 20s was Marxist inspired thinking about sujetness, that is, plotted literature, character and psychological literature on the one hand, plotted literature on the other, plotted literature in the simplistic Marxist terms of that day is what you want, and all of this character-based fiction, there's something wrong with that. So Pidmoheny, who's not at all a Marxist and doesn't really buy into this, but starts with talking about plot structure in Nichoy's work, and then he crosses that off and says, but that's not really important. So that sin is discounted, and he gets to the second sin, but this is the first true sin. The first true sin of our author is the uncultivated shape. This is, you're writing an introduction for someone's collected works. The guy is dead already. You're supposed, what publisher would let you write this? I don't know. This is not a way to sell books. The first true sin of our author is the uncultivated shape of his expression. His works give the impression, as if once having written them, he never read them over. The rough and untidy character of his sentences hurts the eye. All the people who sat by the church got up and began to cross themselves. In Ukrainian, this makes more sense. Kaidash could see the entire hill on which the church stood, and all the people who stood beside the church. He took off his hat and began to cross himself. End of quotation. Little boy Pidmoheny comes back, school marmish. Even an illiterate would figure out to say it this way. All the people who sat by the church got up and began to cross themselves. Kaidash could see the entire hill on which the church stood and all the people beside it. He took off his hat and also began to cross himself. The use of pronouns and adverbs is an elementary, a childish step in the organization of an expression, not just a literary one, but any decent expression. Well, how do you deal with this? That is, we're back to destructive repetition. That is, if this criticism is valid, then of course we shouldn't be reading Nichoy at all. That is, but the accusation is very complicated. That is, he is literally accusing Nichoy of not paying any attention. That is, Nichoy didn't notice that he's repeating the same word instead of putting a pronoun in, because we all know that you're supposed to put pronouns in. Well, what if we don't know that you're supposed to put pronouns in? What if that's not a rule? What if Jakobsonian kind of thinking, what if repetition in the text as a literary work is precisely what makes it a literary work? Pidmoheny, who is from a different generation, this is some kind of modernist writer. I mean, he may also be a realist, but he's much later, and he thinks like a modernist. And for him, you don't slow down the medium, you speed it up. For him, you hide the effects. That is, you build character not by constantly repeating certain words, but you build character by showing the character in its self-expression. There are, of course, many examples of repetition in Nichui that we could look at. But the one I want to look at in particular is an example where we clearly have something that is intentional. That is, we cannot mistake this for an accident by a writer. That is, this isn't just a question of failure to replace nouns with pronouns. This is clearly something constructed. I've got the text on the board in Ukrainian. I'll read it to you in English. The key here is that the place name, Verbyuka, is Willowville, right? And so we've got willows in the text and Willowville as a place name. So near the town of Vasilkiv, the smaller Ostavitsa River quietly flowed across a wide valley between two rows of gently sloping hills. Clumps of lush tall willows. Well, I don't need to read this to you. That is, you can see what's going on. We have a story about a village that is called Willowville, and where willows are a very prominent portion of the description. What's more, this part I will read, there were no fences. Plots were separated only by boundaries or rows of willows. Now, this section, this is in fact the first two paragraphs of the novel. Five paragraphs of the novel are devoted to this introductory scene setting. As, you know, we've got eight willows in this first passage. And that first passage works remarkably like something we are very familiar with. That is, the opening of Dickens' Bleak House, where fog, right?
What's the date of this novel, Max? Excuse me for interrupting.
The Bleak House is what, 1850?
No, but I'm talking about the Nichui novel.
The Nichui novel is 1876. Yeah. He actually rewrote it. He had written it earlier, but we don't have that because his friend Pantelimon Kulij had it stolen from him at the Warsaw train station. He had it in a satchel. You know, and because, of course, Nichui lives in the Russian Empire and can't print his works there, and the works have to go out to the West. And Pantelimon Kulij is the one who was sometimes doing this. He was also editing. And, you know, he lost a whole satchel full of things. So Nichui had written this actually twice and then rewrote it. Probably changed quite a deal on the second version. In any case, we look at those willows. There are only eight willows. I forget, there are 20-some fogs in this passage from Bleak House. And I don't know how many of you remember Bleak House, but in Bleak House, fog isn't just a quality of London, right? That is, if you read over this, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but if you read over this, you'll keep discovering the Lord High Chancellor. In the middle of all this fog sits the Lord High Chancellor. Right? Because what Dickens, of course, is doing with the preponderance of fog in the first page, it's actually a page and a half of Bleak House, is he is creating a metaphor for what is essentially the chief idea in the novel, is that the courts of chancery in Bleak House are foggy in every imaginable way, and no one is ever going to come out of this either a victor or in fact alive, and you know, the characters of Bleak House have their lives destroyed by a litigation process in chancery. So here is a good example of, you know, no one ever wrote about Dickens what Pete Mohaney wrote about Nichui. That is, no one suggests that, you know, Charles, did you notice that you repeated fog 20 times? That is, he certainly did. In those five paragraphs that I'm talking about at the beginning of Mykola Dzeria, the willows, we saw them heavily in the first two paragraphs, and then slowly we have fewer and fewer willows, and somewhere around paragraph 4, we get another sentence with willow. But this one sounds different, right? Because it very specifically talks about, again, That is, the writer throws in this word again because he remembers he's already thrown in too many willows. And in a sense, we've got a kind of easing out of the willows. But that's not enough yet. That is, what we've got now is a natural landscape. That is, we fly into Willowville across the Rostovice River. We see this green village. And it's a good folkloric Ukrainian village. That is, we like how green it is, how natural it is. We got that, right? But that's not all that's going on. In paragraph 5, right after this again mention, Nitschui actually comes out and explains the willows. Remember I told you, I read you that sentence about how the village has no fences, it just has rows of willows. Well, you know, good village boys know this, I wasn't so sure, but Nitschui fortunately explains it to us. In the fifth paragraph of the book, he talks about how the reason these willows are all growing in a row here is because the willow fence posts took root, and now where the fences were in straight lines, we have straight lines of willows. Okay. What's significant about this, and you know, the next step you have to know the novel, the significance here is that the willows have taken root. What this whole novel is about people who are rooted to this village, who are rooted in this land, just like these willows are. That is, in the same way that Dickens uses fog as a metaphor for what is going on in the courts of London, Nitschui is using rootedness, not willows. That is, the concept here is the idea that if you stick a stick in the ground, it will grow. And if you put these people in this land, they will take root here. And the whole storyline of Mykola Czeria is about a man who has to leave. That is, at the beginning of the novel, serfdom is still in place in the Russian Empire. Czeria is getting accused of all kinds of crimes and so on. Czeria runs away. We go through 7 chapters of his escapades in all kinds of different places. He crosses half of Ukraine, ends up in Bessarabia, that is just on the other side, where Russian law stretches but doesn't quite stretch, but there's no serfdom. That's what's important. And lives there until serfdom is abolished, and then comes back to his own village. And when he returns to his own village, he's literally out of place in his own village. That is, he's been uprooted. He no longer fits there. And so rootedness is the key ingredient here. The reason I give this so much attention is to immediately dispel that first notion we had of accidental repetition. Nitschui knows what he's doing. Clearly he understands what he's doing. And he's using this repetition in much the same way that Dickens did in Bleak House. And just because I love these things, and I always pay attention now that I read Nitschui carefully, the Divisha inena Divisha, Dishish inena Dishisha, right? That closes the fifth paragraph. That is, Nitschui repeats and he cannot repeat enough. That is, he knows the rhetorical devices. What we saw here was not only the explanation of a metaphor that informs the novel, but also in the 5 paragraphs, what we saw is a way of pacing the reader through a certain text, through a certain amount of information, through a certain range of images. Nitschui could have explained the willows in the first paragraph. Why don't you explain things like that in the first? Piedmohini would explain it in the first paragraph. He writes in a different style. For Nitschui, this idea of stretching it out across five paragraphs, that is, we start with Willows, we do something else in the meantime, and then we return to Willows. That is, we have another kind of repetition going on, a repetition of closure. That is, we return to this and we block it off. Pinohini strongly dislikes all of this kind of stuff and complains about various things. For example, in the same introduction, he complains about two passages. One I'll be looking at carefully. The other one I'll just mention. He has a complaint that old lady Kaida Shecha comes out to call her family in to lunch. She literally steps out of the door to call them. Then there's an interruption. Nitschui spends two paragraphs going through her biography, a description of her character and all this. And then finally he comes back to this moment and has her yell out to them, lunch is ready, come for lunch. Right? And Pete Moheny complains, what are we doing here? You know, why are we interrupting the flow of the narrative, the flow of the story, in order just to give this characterization? The characterization should be done differently. Well, in his mind, it should be done differently, but it is very characteristic of Nitschui to create something, then meander around it, and then come back and close it. A different kind of repetition and pacing, and this I will certainly leave the Ukrainian on the board, is one of the famous passages from the Kaidasheva Simya, the Kaidash family. That's the title of the novel. And old man Kaidash and his two sons, who are, like everybody else in the village, too lazy to fix the road into the village. So there is this notorious hill with a notorious bump in the road where everybody breaks their you know, at the axles of their wagons, right? And Nitschui is going to describe the scene as their wagon comes over this hill. Now, obviously, this is a comic scene, The key ingredient here is not only that we're going to use repetition, but the word we're going to repeat is tzabeh. Now, tzabeh is a completely untranslatable word because it belongs not to human language, it is the language of oxen. That is, when a Ukrainian peasant talks to an ox, that is, there are two words he uses, sob and tzabeh. Sob is to the left and tzabeh is to the right. It is not used for any other function. That is, it is only draft animals and the two directions, right? So, here we've got old man, держи по тзабеh, right? Карпо, keep to the right, the father yelled at his son. Avoid hitting that damn bump with the wheel. To the right, gray one. To the right, speckled one, yelled Karpo and snapped his whip over the heads of the horned beasts. But just at that moment, he glanced down the hill. Bedecked with flowers and ribbons, Motria was walking past their home. A red skirt, red boots, a belt red as flame, all shone and glowed like pure gold under the morning sun. Well, you know, it's a standard comic scene, right? That is, Karpo is looking at the girl, right? The girl down there, the oxen is going to keep walking, he's not paying attention. You know, the old man has now abandoned the second wagon, he's running up to try to save the first wagon. Why do you repeat tzabeh so many times? It's comedy 101. That is, of course you can speed this up, and then you lose the joke. That is, imagine yourself responsible for an animated feature presenting this scene. Well, you stretch it and stretch it and stretch it as much as you possibly can. And repetition here functions the way it might in music as a timekeeping device. That is, it makes the length of this action longer. Here too, it's a simple device, but once again, we are in a world where clearly we have to do with pacing being used for comic effect. much the same thing. These are all complaints that Pete Mohaney has about Nichuy. There is a story of, once again, Karpov visiting the other girl, Milashka, and she is decorating her home, standard Ukrainian folklore. She is whitewashing the peach, right? And she's got a bucket of red clay and a bucket of white clay. And it's something out of Saturday morning cartoons, right? Karpov walks in there, eventually the red clay spills, and, you know, we've got the usual consternation. But Pete Mohaney, in his complaints, is saying, and what about that white bucket? That is, the moment we walked in, the author said there's a white bucket and a red bucket, right? And the red bucket has already spilled, and we're going on for 5 pages, and, you know, did he forget about the white bucket? And after 5 pages, says Pete Mohaney, well, we're about ready to write off the white bucket, but no, Karpov trips and steps into the white bucket. Right? Humor 101. That is, once again, you slow this down, you create a circular structure, but you need to slow down the rhythm as much as possible for comic effect. Which raises the obvious question, how much do you slow it down? That is, what is the measure in a comedian's repertoire of how long you slow this down? Well, the key ingredient here is that Nichuy is a writer from the 19th century. That is, for him, that slowing down is slower than it would be for a writer in the 20th century, certainly than it would be for a writer like Pete Mohaney. This same kind of logic can be seen in an essay by Andriy Nikolsky, another critic from the 20s, and he's the one who actually, you know, concentrated on this plottedness, character versus plot. He talks about Pete Mohaney, and he talks about the possibility of, he talks about Nichuy in the context of presenting a European listener these works, that is, a European reader. And so what he's setting up, once again, following the kind of thinking Yefremov used, that, you know, Nichuy doesn't belong to the modern world. Nichuy is old-fashioned. Let's take a modern European and give him these works to read, and what will he find? He'll start to complain about the deficient and lame dramatic tension in the scenes, admonish Levitsky for the gray and forlorn destiny of his heroes. Plenty of things in the novel do not end in any way at all. That's a very key phrase. And there's truth in that. That is, anyone who reads Nichuy Levitsky will eventually discover that lots of his stories don't go anywhere in particular. Even the one I just described to you, the Mykola Jedya story, that is, Mykola Jedya, a victim of serfdom, leaves his village, returns to his village much later, and is a misfit in his old age. That is, by this time his wife has died, he returns home to find his children there, but his children don't even know him. He's been away all his life. So he no longer fits in his community. So this rootedness issue, okay, we see that working. But what point has he made? That is, the reader is looking for something enlightening, something ennobling, some moral to this story, some takeaway message. Even serfdom as an evil force, that is, so much realist literature in Russia in the 19th century takes serfdom as the cause, right? That is, we need to show that serfdom was terrible. Well, this novel doesn't show that serfdom was terrible, because as if by magic, serfdom disappears and Mykola goes home. And in fact, all those scenes are comic. That is, the abolition of serfdom is a comic scene in this novel, because they're all being sued in Bessarabia as being runaway serfs, But they've all acquired names that they took out of a cemetery, right? So they are now different people. And it's another comic scene, right? So there's no moral to the story. We have just created a circle. We have come back to Verbilka, but we haven't intellectually moved forward. We haven't achieved anything. And that is a real issue when it comes to dealing with Nitschui's plots. Repetition as an alternative to plot is something that we don't much consider. That is, can repetition work as a structuring agent? It very often does just that in Nitschui's work. That is, I won't take too much time. I talked about Mikolajeria. Let me talk about a novel entitled Starosvitsky Batyushka. Starosvitsky Batyushka in Matryoshka. Old world priests and their wives, right? Orthodox world, priests are married. The story consists of one generation. That is, at the beginning of the story, a young man succeeds his father as priest, and at the end of the story, that man is going to die and be succeeded by another round of priests, right? So a simple kind of, you know, Tolstoyan kind of large historical canons. The story is structured around two families. There has to be the one old world priest and the new world priest. They're both the same generation. They vie for the same girl. This guy gets the girl in the parish. The other guy doesn't. But the other guy, the new world priest, is an educated man. And the novel reflects Nitschui was sixth generation clergy. He was the first oldest son in the family who didn't become a clergyman, but his brother did. They'd been clergy as far back as time could tell. So he knew a lot about religious life. And he describes a world that is characteristic, if you know your Russian ecclesiastical history, the church reforms in the middle of the 19th century that brought in an educated clergy. That is, the Russian church had been working on this for a long time. It didn't all happen at once. But there is a gradual movement to move the clergy out of ignorance, because village clergymen were very often illiterate and not really any brighter than their parishioners, and move them into a more professional category, people who had seminaries and so on. That's the world he is comparing. That is, we have a priest who is the son of the old priest, elected by the villagers to be the priest, and then we have the new priest coming in who has completed a seminary education. He thinks very highly of himself. He's an intellectual man and so on. The novel progresses through the lives of these two priests in strict parallel. It's all repetition. That is, this priest has children, this priest has children. This priest's children get married, the other priest's children get married. This priest has trouble with his wife, the other priest has trouble with his wife. We just go through chapter by chapter, comparing the various episodes in these people's lives. And then we reach the end. The old guy dies. You know, he actually dies because the bishop comes and yells at him. And the bishop scares him so much that he has a heart attack, and that's the end of him, right? There you go, little jab at you know, ecclesiastical authority here. But nevertheless, he dies. He will be succeeded by one of his sons. The other guy is aging and also clearly will be succeeded by someone, right? And the novel ends. Right? And the novel ends with, you know, both families living miserable lives as they have for the last 10 years, right? We've gotten nowhere, right? Nitschui hasn't even focused on ecclesiastical reform. That is, a realist novelist may have spent a good deal of time talking about the effects of the church reforms. But he doesn't. The novel does not do that. That is, only we who know the facts outside bring that to the novel. He never mentions church reform. It's not part of the text. That is, only the characters, only the story is part of the text. And that, in all honesty, is my problem with Nitschke. That is, you know, I won't go through a dozen more novels showing how Nitschke's circular plots are not really plotted. That is, they don't go anywhere. He uses repetition. He will return to a certain point. And he will do this all along in the text. He'll do this in chapters. He'll do it in sections of chapters. He'll try to do this in most novels where they just come back to a certain point. And the problem I have is, how do we deal with this in an analytical sense? What I came up with, I spent some time talking about this in the book, but I admit in advance, rather inadequately, is something I call non-purposeful storytelling. That is, when the object of the storytelling is not the moral of the story. The object of the storytelling is the texture of the story. And Nitschke is that kind of a writer. This is not to say that his stories never go anywhere, or that there's never any point to it. But when we read Nitschke, what impresses us most is this non-purposeful storytelling. That is, as we go through page after page of the text, it's the texture of the telling that speaks to us, rather than some sense of we are on the road to somewhere. Because most of the time, we're not on the road anywhere. We're not going somewhere. We are in the moment and experiencing this text. And the key ingredient to achieve that is repetition. Thank you.